on the East Coast, there was Eddie Carlton's tribute to Buddy. Each sold-out performance began with a declaration of musical debt to the real Buddy in heaven. But scores of female fans, too young to remember, declared that Eddie was the one and only. The Deep South was Leonard Hank Taylor's turf. So closely did Leonard capture his country hero's heart and soul, he often confided to friends, "I can only pretend the hurtin' won't claim my life, too." The West Coast was in the grip of Patrick Nelson, who did Sid. Chants of Sid lives, rose at every performance, and usually followed the star back to his hillside retreat, where an aide would pass on this message from Patrick: "Yes, Sid will never die." Between those operators, the big-time tribute racket was pretty well sewed up. New talent had it tough breaking in. But from the north, there was coming a man who would one day smash the order and shape an all-new and almighty tribute empire. His name was Ronnie Boyles. He had a dream.
That's the beginning to one of Stephen Penny's unfinished versions of Crime Wave.
Welcome back to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and joining me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
How, Kimosabi.
And also joining us this week, all the way from Baltimore, Charm City, Maryland, is Skiz Sizek.
Hey!
This week we're looking at the film Crime Wave. Now, this isn't the classic film noir, or even the film by Sam Raimi. No, this is two words, crime and wave, and it was released on VHS as The Big Crime Wave. It's exotic, it's from Canada after all, part of the Winnipeg film scene from the early 80s. Crime Wave is the brainchild of John Pays. He directed, wrote, and stars in Crime Wave, where he plays Stephen Penny, a quiet man. Stephen wants to make the best color crime movie in the world. He lives over the garage of Kim, played by Eva Kovacs, and struggles with creativity as he keeps coming up with great beginnings and endings of a screenplay, but can't quite get the middles. This leads to some great scenes of those beginnings and endings, along with Stephen's life as a failing artist. And believe me, it's hilarious.
So, Michael, this was your pick this week. Why did you choose Crime Wave?
Well, I'm a huge fan of this movie. It's one of those that gives you more with each viewing. And it's one of those struggling artist films like Barton Fink, you know, but this one ends a little bit better than that one does, which is funny because it didn't really originally end the way that it does now. But really, I need to stop for a second and thank Skiz for turning me on to this movie and ask him why he's such a fan and why he's such a big proponent of the film.
Well, thanks. It's funny you mentioned Barton Fink because that was a film about writer's block that I believe the Coen brothers wrote while having writer's block. And Crime Wave is also a film about writer's block. And to me, it's one of those writer's block cures. Like if you're trying to write something and you can't think of something, you can't come up with a good idea, pop Crime Wave in. And for me, my brain just explodes with ideas whenever I watch this movie. I discovered it by accident in a thrift store that had bought up the library of a video store that had gone out of business, and they were selling off all the tapes real cheap. And just the box caught my attention. I don't usually just buy videotapes without knowing what they are, but this one, for some reason, it called my name. And I swear, when I popped it in the very first time, within 10 minutes, I knew that this was going to be one of my all-time favorite movies. And it is. And every time I show it to somebody, I try to get them to predict what's going to happen next. They can never do it. It's a completely original kind of story. Unlike most movies where you kind of know, okay, that character is going to die, or those two characters are going to hook up, or here's how this is going to end. You cannot predict what's going to happen next in Crime Wave.
It's funny that you talk about the box cover being what really turned you on initially about this, because I know that John Pays hates that cover art, which is funny because I love it. I think that is great. And it kind of, for me, it kind of speaks to what the whole movie's about. You know, for folks that don't know, it's a beautiful little drawing painting of John Pays there with this kind of, I don't know, like a little bit devilish look on his face. And isn't, I think his tongue is sticking out like he's trying to concentrate or come up with an idea, and he's in front of a typewriter. And then there's what, the two balloons over his head, right? With
One is of him as Stephen Penny looking kind of Walt Disney-like. And then the other one is Dr. Jolly, who's just an interesting character to look at in the first place. I think it was those two pictures that really caught my attention. Plus the fact that I at the time, I loved the Raimi crime wave. And I picked this up originally thinking it might have had something to do with that. But I was pleasantly surprised when it didn't.
Isn't it really funny how random cover arts you see on a VHS or DVD and it's just something that kind of sticks out at them? It intrigues you no matter, have no idea what it's about, but there's just something about that art that you really like and you have this compulsion to check it out.
Yeah. Now I know Skiz worked at a video store for a lot of years, so you probably have the same, I don't know if you want to call it a problem or not that I do, but when I think of movies, I immediately think of the cover art, and there are some that really turn you on and some that have just, completely turned you off. And it's, I know we're getting off topic, but hey, it's, it's our show. We can do whatever the fuck we want to do. But there's a website that I was looking at recently that's all supposed to be bad art from science fiction books, and I'm looking through there and I'm just like, this to me looks fascinating. There were so many covers where I'm just like, I want to buy the book based on this cover art alone. And I've actually been really turned on to a lot of good books by buying them from their crazy cover art. And then when it came to video, I don't know what the problem was, but there were so many crappy video covers for good films out there that it was just like, yeah, I'm never going to rent that movie based on the cover. But Crime Wave was definitely an exception. It's cover art matched its greatness. So,
but on that same token, how many movies did you guys investigate back then that had bad cover art and the movie was bad?
There was a lot of that.
A lot.
Yeah. I know, me too.
And then there were a lot that had great cover art where the movie was just awful, But I do love the novelty cover art, like Frankenhooker and what was that one? Black Roses, that was kind of 3D.
It had the raised raised.
Yeah. That was cool stuff.
Do you remember seeing the cover for the movie Creep? Tim Ritter made this movie called Creep.
I don't think so. What did it look like?
It just had this guy behind the girl, like grabbing her by the throat. She's screaming. It was just a single image, the big black letters, Creep.
Okay.
And he rented it. And it was like the shot on video, really nasty, like gory, slasher movie.
Right, right.
What's interesting about Crime Wave, though, is that I've never seen a copy of it in a video store for a movie that I love. And all the video stores I worked at, I've never actually seen this movie on the shelf anywhere.
Yeah, that's true. I know it wasn't at the Blockbusters that I worked at, and it wasn't at the little family video store around here. So yeah, apparently it really got a lot of play on late night TV in Canada, and that's why Canadians know about it so much. But down here in the States, there's just really not a whole lot of folks that know about it.
It's really interesting, too, because, looking at the documentary, the short Canadian television documentary, it really leaves you to wonder, had Crime Wave actually been distributed properly, even on video? I mean, there was tons of outlets in the United States that it could have been seen on. Like, it could have showed on Night Flight, which would have gave it a huge following, So, it's kind of like, it's cursed, kind of.
Yeah, it is a little cursed. It does seem really, I mean, I've been fighting, and I think Skiz has been fighting to get more folks to know about this movie for years. I mean, Skiz brought it down to the Maryland Film Festival years ago, and, he's not one to be shy about telling folks, like, hey, there's this movie you need to check out. But, yeah, it's just, it's almost like the movie doesn't want to be seen. And I know that the director does not want to be interviewed. So, unfortunately, John was unavailable to speak to us this episode. But
interviewed for a podcast, right?
Interviewed for a podcast, so...
He was very gracious in allowing me to interview him for Cashiers several years ago.
Right, right, which was very cool of him to do. And, he's not an unpersonable guy. When I was up in Toronto a few months ago, he came out and we had dinner and he was very, very nice. And just like you, Skiz, I had a big problem actually hearing words coming out of his mouth since he plays Stephen Penny completely silent through the entire film. So,
I mean, I've told this story. I think I even tell it in the Cashier's book, but I'd seen the movie about 100 times. When I finally met John Pays in person, the first time he spoke, it just suddenly hit me like, man, I know this guy's face so well, but I have never heard his voice until this moment.
I was so proud of myself that I got to remember to say, so you're John Pays. I thought you'd be bigger. So fortunately, we did have a chance to talk to a couple of the actors from Crime Wave, Eva Kovacs and Neil Lowry. So let's go ahead and we'll hear those interviews. They're pretty short, but they're both pretty good. I know you said that you don't have a whole lot of memories about Crime Wave. Since how old were you when you started shooting that?
Well, you know what? I was just looking for some of the stuff that I had, and I couldn't find it. What's the year that's mentioned on the movie?
I believe it's 85.
Okay. So I was born in 74, so that would have made me 11. And we actually worked on it, I think, for almost the span of 3 years, 2 or 3 years, because we shot a bunch of stuff and then it went to a festival and then John decided that he wanted to rework some of it. And so actually in the movie, you can tell that there's definitely, I've aged. There are some parts where I look older and some parts where I look younger. So I think we probably started maybe when I was 10 and finished when I was 13, I'd say. But you know what? It was just such a grassroots project that, you know, I was in school. It's not like it was big budget. So it wasn't like we would take time off school to shoot anything. So it was literally done on the weekends. You know, he would come by our place and pick me up, and sometimes my sister, because she had a couple small roles in the movie also. So he would come and pick us up, and we'd go to McDonald's, grab some hash browns, and then off we'd go to the shoot.
So how did you get involved with this?
It's so funny, hey? Timing is everything. It's kind of interesting because John Pays is Hungarian, and so am I. And so there's kind of a tight-knit Hungarian community in Winnipeg, where we're both from. And I would often recite poems at these Hungarian functions. And so his parents dragged him along to one particular event, and so there I was reciting some kind of a poem. And so then he approached me and my parents and said, hey, you know what, I'm working on this movie and I've got this young character in it. And, you know, I'd really like Eva to read for the part and see if that might work. You know, maybe she could be in this movie. So I can't even remember how long after that, maybe a couple of weeks, he stopped by our place, brought a script, and, you know, I read a few scenes. And then he called me back, I think probably a few days later, and offered me the part.
I know you said that it took you like 3 years to do this, but like how often was that? Was that like every weekend or just a couple weekends? I mean, did you ever get tired of, you know, this weird guy coming around and stuff?
No, because I loved it. It was so much fun. I mean, John was, I guess he was, what, 27, 28, I think, at the time. And so he was working on this with his buddies, with some of his friends from, I believe, university. And so, you know, there was John, and he had a couple other guys, Tom and Jerry, who would come along. And it was really fun. I mean, John was a blast. I remember so many times one of the crew members had a motorcycle, so he'd bring his motorcycle by, and, you know, they'd kind of take me for a ride in the motorcycle, and you know, like, it was fun. I had a great time. I guess the one funny thing about it really was just that, so we're working on this movie, and I think it just seemed very strange to explain to your friends that you're in a movie. Well, what's the movie called? Crime Wave. Okay, well, what's the movie about? And I didn't really know what it was about. I would get sections of scenes that we were going to be shooting, and I would practice my lines, memorize them, and we'd shoot them. But I had no idea as far as the chronology in the movie, how it actually all fit together. They were all just these isolated chapters for me. So I didn't even really know a lot about what the movie was about. But the cool thing was that John and the folks in the crew, they were really good at explaining different things about what they were doing. You know, they would show me, you know, how they were setting up the shots. And like I said, my sister, who's 3.5 years older than I am, she'd come along as well. I mean, she would do my hair. We picked clothes out of my wardrobe. Like, it was just really low budget. It didn't even seem like anything special other than it was just really fun. And so I find it really amazing that, you know, so many years later, people are still watching the movie, people are still interested in the movie, and that it really has this really interesting following. Like, I'll have people just here in Winnipeg sometimes come up to me and say, hey, are you the Eva from Crime Wave? And it just absolutely blows me away. It's kind of neat that the things that kind of stick with you with these moments, like I said, there are, you know, probably details of some of the behind the scenes stuff that I probably wouldn't really know. But the things that really hit home for me are just really like the individual experiences that we had. You know, there were a couple scenes that were shot for the movie that were never used that I remember were really kind of cool. There was one scene that was taken out. Stephen Penny in the movie is showing Cam all these cool things about how to make movies, and under the bed is showing how the camera works, and, you know, we're having that big party in his apartment suite with the balloons and all of that stuff. There was one scene where he's showing me how they fake cutting somebody's neck, and so they had this big massive knife and they had the little tube with fake blood on it. And so there was a scene where he's literally, you know, like, you know, dragging this knife across my throat, and there goes the blood dripping. And, you know, we think it's all kind of funny, but of course, it's kind of creepy, right? Because here's this creepy guy doing this crazy stuff. And I remember that scene never quite made it. Well, you know, it was so funny. Like, I think he was driving a Subaru at the time, and he would crack open the trunk. And so when we'd go to the shoot and he'd talk about, okay, what are we shooting today? Yeah, I remember him breaking open the trunk and showing me the leg, the severed leg that they used for the scene when the Amway folks or whoever they were end up getting their legs shot off, and there's the woman, you know, kind of hobbling across the sidewalk. So, you know, oh yeah, here's this leg, check this out. We use this for one of the scenes. You know, it's just all so fascinating and so, it's just so interesting and fun. They made it a lot of fun.
Is that what sparked your interest in showbiz?
I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. Yeah. I mean, I did lots of, like I said, I recited poems and stuff when I was young. So that was just something that I did. And then when we did the movie, I just really enjoyed it. And so I think initially when I went to school, I was thinking about being a speech pathologist or something, and worked on that for a little bit. And then I was a pharmacy technician. And then I thought, you know what? I just really need to try something else. And so there's just this burning desire to do some reporting. So then I went to school and did that. And I just really loved it. It just always felt kind of comfortable.
How was it when, after he, you know, did the premiere in Toronto and came back again, was it just like, okay, cool, we get to shoot some more? Or was it, oh no, I have to reshoot all of these scenes again? Or how was that?
I think he seemed mainly apologetic about it, because it did take a lot of time. It, you know, it ate up a lot of weekends and stuff. And I think he just felt badly that, you know, here I am being a burden, getting you to keep working on this thing. And I think he probably wanted it to just be finished, right? He wanted it to be accepted and embraced. And I guess having to go back and shoot some more, and then realizing that, oh gosh, like one of the main characters in this movie is getting older. You know, how are we going to make this work with me getting older so that it actually still fits?
It sounds like everything was recorded in post as far as all the voice. Was that just done like in a sound studio, or where did you record all the voice and how did you do that?
We did them in various different places, to be honest. I mean, we did some audio on set, but we did some in a local studio in Winnipeg. And then I remember they kind of fixed up a spot in, I can't remember if it was one of the film guys or audio guys who was on set. We basically went into either his place or his parents' place in the basement and kind of rigged up our own little sound booth there. So we did some stuff there. We did some stuff in a studio. I guess as things came along, he just seemed to find solutions. And so it wasn't like you've got this intense 2-month project. I mean, as things would change and things would evolve, you'd have to find a different fix for each situation. And so he was just really resourceful and trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to make this work? How are we going to finish this thing up?
You said that people have come up to you and recognized you. I mean, what was the immediate response? Was there, because I've seen some news reports of, you know, oh, here's this young filmmaker from Winnipeg. And, you know, was there any kind of local swell, or was it just like, you know, he put it out there and nothing happened, or what was it like?
You know, John, obviously, because you've spoken to him before, he's such a humble guy, you know, and so he's certainly not going to be the first person who's going to, you know, parade around with this project that he's done. But when the movie was first finished, there was a small little movie theater in town. I don't even know how many people it sat, but it was kind of like a little community theater. And so I remember it first aired there, and, you know, we had our family come out and a bunch of people that he knew. And so, you know, some people saw it at that time. And then as time kind of goes on, it's interesting because I guess as more people study the film and it gets more exposure, and, you know, locally here in Canada, there was a super channel that would run on at obscure times at like 3 or 4 in the morning, I guess, for Canadian content. So people who'd be up late at night would see it and then realize, oh my gosh, this thing's from Winnipeg. And so I actually hear way more about it now than I did back then, which is what I find so interesting, is that, you know, as people kind of look at this film and see what he managed to do with the resources that he had and how he could really be so creative with what he did. Yeah, it just makes me so proud of him for being able to do it and getting the recognition now for all the hard work and all the effort that he put into it.
Yeah, you're right. He is totally humble. And it's like, it seems like there's a lot of that Stephen Penny in him, you know?
Totally. Totally. And that's exactly it. It completely mirrors his life in so many ways, right? Just sort of, he's this talented person. He's a good looking guy. You know, he's got all sorts of things going for him. And he is just so low key.
I wanted to ask who your sister played in the film.
She had two roles. She played the teacher in the classroom scene where I'm daydreaming and drawing the outline of the body on my notepad. I think it's kind of earlier on in the movie where I'm daydreaming about the stuff that I'm learning about filmmaking and stuff. So she was the teacher who tells Kim to be quiet. And then she's also the bully in the playground where I guess her name is Jane. And I said, Jane, big fat pain. Yeah. And she said, oh, this was so great because my family was pretty strict. You know, they're Hungarian immigrant family and very strict. And so it was such a big deal because my sister had to say, wait till I get you alone, you little shit. And I was like, oh my God, she said shit. It was just so funny. And then even just, you know, some of those little scenes where we're eavesdropping through the vent, Kim's parents are having sex in the other room and me saying, oh yeah, they always do it after that. Like, I don't even think I really knew for a while what that meant, you know? And so it's really fascinating as I get older and I watch the film and I see so many different layers to it that totally went over my head when we were shooting it.
When you were working with, and I can't believe their names are Tom and Jerry, but when you were working with Tom and Jerry and John, I mean, you really only worked with just a few other actors. Did you ever really work with any of the people that were in, like, the script part of it? Or, you know,
No.
Okay, you didn't even have a scene with, like, Dr. Jolly or anybody either. Just, like, your parents and your sister and the kids at school, right?
Yep. And so that's why I think as a kid I had no clue. Like, how does this all work together? Because another really neat thing is that John wrote it out. A lot of the scripts and a lot of the lines. I mean, I don't even know what his master copy looks like, but when he would show up at our place with the lines that I needed to prepare for the next shoot, they were written out by hand. It's fascinating to me. Yeah, I mean, just the level of work behind that, it's amazing.
And then you did get to be in the party scene and meet the other quiet man, which is always one of my favorites.
And that too is so neat because it was shot really late at night and it was a really long shoot. I think actually that probably was the longest shoot that we had. And that was done at John's parents' place. And it was so fun to be getting all dressed up in a little costume and having all those other people there. And I remember just, I was pretty big by the end of the night. I think I was probably catching some Z's in the car outside on the street or something while we were waiting for some of the shoots because it took so long to set everything up. And I'm sure it's like that with most movie sets, right? But it just takes forever to get things ready and get things organized. And so there's a lot of the downtime. You know, you only have so many opportunities to get all those people together. And so you really had to maximize that opportunity when you had everyone at once. And so I think most of that whole scene was done in one shot in one evening.
After school, Stephen showed me some more of his neat stuff. Hi, Stephen. He showed me his camera that was made in Switzerland and wound up like an old kind of watch. It was called a Bolex. Lots of beginner people use them, and also Chekhov from Star Trek and Yoko Ono too. Stephen said it was a very good camera. Stephen also showed me the film he used. It was called 7291, and it was made by Kodak. Stephen liked to watch the tape sparkle blue when it came off the can. You had to be in the dark to see it. Stephen said it was a very good film. That was one of Stephen's attacks of self-doubt. Later, his self-doubt would make him want to quit writing Crime Wave.
How long was the shoot for you?
Well, actually, it extended from 84 to 86. John took one version of the film to the Toronto Film Festival in 85, and he wasn't pleased with the audience reaction to the last third of it. So he came back, he rewrote the script, and reshot the last third. And then that version was released in March of 87, and that's the one you normally see today.
Right, with the whole Stephen Penny triumphant ending, where you get your feet washed, which is great.
Yes, that's right. That's the second version.
So how did you get involved with the project?
Yes, I started with Springtime in Greenland. I played the householder showing off his home of tomorrow. And then I played a father in Oak Ivy and Other Dead Elms. And then Reeves the butler in the international style. So Crime Wave was my fourth. They're often released under the title The Three Worlds of Nick, all three films.
Had you always wanted to be an actor, or was just this something that you lucked into, or how did that happen?
No, I was more a film buff than an aspiring actor. I just, on one occasion, signed up to be an extra in a movie that was being shot in Winnipeg as a film buff, so I could have a peek behind the scenes. It was Silence of the North with Ellen Burstyn. Well, I'm not on screen, so if you're looking for me, I'm not there. But part of the process, they took my photograph, and I happened to be dressed up in my tie and blazer. This photograph got into the hands of John and Greg Klimkue, who was producing Springtime in Greenland. And they thought I had the look of a typical yuppie who would be right for their householder role. So Greg called me up. That's how I got started. John just called me to do a bit in this next one, and then the next, and then Crime Wave.
I won't say it was a huge role, because you're really not in it for that long, at least as far as Dr. Jolly goes, but you make such an impact when you're on screen. Was that character written that way, or what did you bring to that? I mean, you portray that really creepy vibe very, very well, I have to say.
Thank you. Well, I just recognized it initially as a great role when I was reading it. Normally, I find the role's easy to play if it comes off the paper easily, and that was certainly the case with this one. I recognized Dr. Jolly as a movie type, the smooth-talking, seemingly sane madman, and I simply tried to portray that type in a heightened fashion so as to parody him, and seemed to come off rather well.
Now, was everything that you did on the page, or did you come up with anything on your own?
I made a multitude of suggestions to John, and he always received them politely. Discarded most of them, but on occasion he would agree to a little something I might suggest. Nothing substantive, really. Basically, what you see on screen is what he wrote for me. Well, you mentioned that hand-washing scene. You may notice that after the hand-washing scene, they have a hug. And then Dr. Jolly's hands start exploring. I added that. Another little one. When Dr. Jolly's playing horsey with his victim, it was initially suggested I sing Happy Trails, Roy Rogers' theme song, and I suggested Back in the Saddle Again, Gene Autry's theme song, which I thought more apropos given what was going on. Actually, that scene was partially shot in 84 and some of it in 86. It's seamless. You can't tell from shot to shot which is which. But the whole thing was redone.
Right, yeah, to put clothes back on the guy in the bed, right?
Well, there was a different guy in the bed. That was basically why it was reshot. The initial chap was rather small and smooth-bodied, and some people in Toronto thought it was a young boy and reacted quite angrily. I think there were a few walkouts. John didn't want that, so got Greg Klim, who was his sound man, to portray the victim. He was obviously an adult. And we reshot the scene.
I know that you were in the prison scene in the reshot ending. Was there anything else that had to be, and then the scene with the young man, was there anything else that had to be reshot? Because it's right around the time that you are attacking Steven, which is where like the bulk of the changes kind of happen, if memory serves.
Well, come to think of it, the extreme close-up where I confront Steven in the field, the close-up part of that was reshot, which I was particularly glad of. I forget why he shot it, but I noticed in the initial version I blinked once, and I was disappointed with myself there because I wanted an unbroken gaze that I managed to achieve in the reshoot.
And then you got that great weird accent going on too. Is that your Texas drawl?
That's my Texas drawl, my Brownsville drawl. Exactly how people speak in Brownsville, I don't know, but that's how I imagine they do.
Texas meets Manitoba, right?
Yes.
Hello, sport. What's that? Not sweet enough. Well, that's why they call it unsweetened. You like oranges, don't you? Well, it's the same thing. Yes. Yes. All right. Be good. Bye-bye.
And as a special bonus this week, we've got an interview with Greg Klimke. He was one of the behind-the-scenes guys at Crime Wave and producer of some of John Pace's short films. He's also a producer of Careful, Archangel, quite a few other Guy Madden films, and he was even an actor in The Heart of the World. He played the Hungry Capitalist. So let's go ahead and listen to that interview. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me today.
Any opportunity I can to, shall we say, publicly or privately shill the genius that is John Pace, I'm always happy to do.
Yeah, he is a very underrated artist.
Not just underrated, but surprisingly overlooked. And that's always been an odd one to me because I remember quite well in the 80s, certainly when a number of his short films opened at the Toronto International Film Festival. Those films received some domestic support critically, most notably from the really great and late Canadian critic Jay Scott, who, he wrote in, Canada's, I guess, newspaper of record, our pathetic version of, shall we say, the New York Times, the Toronto Globe and Mail, but a newspaper of record enough, and certainly Jay Scott was a critic of international renown enough that I was kind of surprised that his championing of John's shorts at the time, weren't enough to make more international critics take notice of him. And then years later, of course, when Crime Wave premiered at that same festival, Jay Scott went completely and utterly insane over that particular film. And Crime Wave was such a momentous event at the time for all saw it in Toronto that I thought even more that Jay's proclamation that if anyone was going to finally make the great Canadian comedy, it would be John Pace. Certainly high praise from a critic who, quite frankly, was in the leagues of people like Jerry Perry or Jim Hoberman, Dave Kerr. The list kind of could go on. I mean, and again, it was weird because even then, I know Jerry Perry from Boston, who was stringing for a lot of Canadian publications, ended up taking Jay Scott's bait, seeing the film, going insane, and he became one of John's biggest supporters, writing about John's work whenever he could. And yet, for some reason, beyond that, the critical reception never quite snowballed into the kind of wider acceptance I thought it deserved. He had his supporters, though, at the time, and they were very, very respected and respectable supporters. But somehow, I think you know yourself, there's, you know, you can have one or two champions in the mainstream press, but for movies as delicate and seemingly small as Crime Wave, sometimes you need a heck of a lot more.
Definitely seems like those who have seen it will never forget it and will sing its praises as high as they possibly can. So how did you get involved with the whole thing? Was it just that you were running in that same circle of filmmakers, or?
My relationship with John is an interesting one. It goes back to the student newspaper at the University of Manitoba, the Manitoban. John and I didn't actually know each other. We knew each other by reputation. I don't think we actually laid eyes on each other in the student newspaper newsroom where I practically lived for many years of my wayward slacker youth. John was doing this weekly cartoon strip called Saps and Sinners with, you know, the main character was this bloodhoundish-like dog, but who was adorned in the regalia of 40s noir detectives. And it was one of the most brilliant comic strip series I could imagine. You know, it was this sort of noirish mystery, but with, you know, lots of Lollapalooza dames and amazing narrative and visuals and really funny. And, you know, of course, you know, to have this sort of noirish detective slavering all over these dames, being a big bloodhound with, you know, Humphrey Bogart regalia on him was really funny. And I love this comic strip. And it's interesting because at the time, I sort of admired him from afar, had no idea he was making films. And in turn, from the way he has often described it to me, and I think how it sort of played out, is that I was writing movie reviews for the university paper. And, you know, to say my film reviews at the time were outrageous is an understatement, because essentially, I was doing Joe Bob Briggs before Joe Bob Briggs existed. Yet, you know, within the ivy towers of a university, in particular a university newspaper, and applying the sort of what became the Joe Bob Briggs standards, but to not just genre films, but to all films, including all the, you know, a bunch of hallowed art films. So needless to say, the newspaper was always flooded with just the most irate letters to the editor about my pieces. And at the same time, so was John's comic strip. Again, there was all this controversy at the time about it because, you know, people saying it's misogynistic, it was sexist, you know, and you got to realize this is the late 70s, which was a pretty open time, yet it was sort of the very early beginnings, I might add, of political correctness. So we admired each other from afar. And eventually what happened is that, you know, I dabbled in all kinds of stuff in those early days. And one of the things I was doing, there was this former porn cinema, and it, you know, the owner was all depressed because he was being prosecuted for, you know, obscenity all the time, and he decided he wanted to go straight, and I wound up there as his programmer. You know, I can't remember how old I was at the time, you know, must have been about 20, and I ended up programming this really crazy art cinema. And it was interesting because what I specialized in, it was a repertory cinema, and Winnipeg was really cool at the time, because it actually did have a lot of tons of rep cinemas and ways of seeing cool stuff. It's hard to believe that Winnipeg was this hotbed of being able to watch really great cinema. Anyway, what ended up happening is I specialized in running a rep house that in turn was specializing in cult films. And one day I get this telephone call at the student newspaper from John, and he says, look, we should meet already. I make movies. I want you to see them. And yeah, it was very cool. He used to have this really amazing office in his father's construction company in Winnipeg. It was the coolest little office, and he had a little screening room in there, and he basically showed me a whole bunch of his movies, including his latest at the time, which was The Obsession of Billy Botsky. And I gotta tell you, that movie just, I mean, I love the stuff he was showing me, but The Obsession of Billy Botsky blew me the hell away, because it was like, oh my God. he's somehow capturing everything about my life, the life of my peers and colleagues and friends in, as he called it, his winter city. And I thought, this is amazing. This guy's making movies that lots of people would love, and yet they're indigenously rooted as well in Winnipeg. So I thought that was really cool. And he basically said, can you play my movie? And I said, yes, of course. And he and I worked together, and I promoted this premiere showing and the theater I was running at the time. So what ended up happening is we played this film, and it was about, you know, it's a big theater. There were just under 1,000 seats there, and just like packed the place. And John and I cleaned up, because even though I was programming the place, I didn't own the cinema. So I actually four-walled the cinema. And I can tell you, Johnny and I made a good chunk of change that night. And eventually, I think he just, you know, he just said, hey, making more shorts, do you want to produce them for me? And I just said, yeah, I guess so. I had no idea what being a producer meant. But I was with John for the rest of the shorts, the Three Worlds of Nick trilogy. I would actually say, in many ways, it was my first producing experience. And I certainly wasn't the seasoned producer. But, you know, I had a good flair, and I had a good sort of schmata salesman, Winnipeg wholesale mentality. And, you know, in essence, I was probably what you would call these days a line producer or a production manager. But I got to tell you, doing those shorts with John was just such a thrill, because I was not only acting in them, I was helping him mount the pictures. And it was just always a lot of fun. And so what eventually happened, I think, is that many years later, I was going to produce Crime Wave, and something really horrible happened. I was living with someone at the time who basically started, you know, this is the thing that eventually happens sometimes in certain relationships, was getting this whole, when are you going to get a life, from the woman I was living with. I certainly was getting that from the family a lot. And two things that I regret at that time sort of not doing was, number one, I was supposed to actually have one of the lead roles. Guy Madden had essentially written it for me in Tales from the Gimli Hospital. And that was the role of, you know, there was Gunnar and Einar, and I was supposed to play the role of the fat guy. And I was supposed to produce John's film, Crime Wave, at the same time. And like an idiot, I just begged off doing both. And went into this weird headspace of getting around to finishing my degree and deciding I was going to go to law school, and ended up applying to a million law schools, getting accepted to all of them. And then I think what eventually happened at the time is I turned all of those opportunities down to take a what amounted to a minimum wage job as a director of distribution and marketing for the Winnipeg Film Group. The woman I was living with left me, but that was good, because I entered into this really exciting phase of my life. And it was around that time that Johnny was making Crime Wave on his own. And, you know, as per the way he usually worked, you know, he was always, he never shot his film in, like, you know, 30 days straight or anything like that. He'd shoot a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, a little bit there. Sometimes shooting would stretch out to over a year and a half or something like that. So I ended up taking a bunch of cameo roles, helping him with casting, and of course, you know, taking one of my most beloved and favorite small roles, the dog breeder who has the immortal line, I come 100 miles to breed this here bitch.
What seems to be the trouble?
I'm afraid I can't let you pass. Sales is temporarily off limits. I'm not authorized to say why at this time. Do you have business in sales?
I got business in sales. I come 100 miles to breed this here bitch, and I want to know what's going on.
Now, hold on a second. That ain't no way to talk now, is it?
What is it? Town on fire or what?
Look, I don't have to tell you nothing. Now, if you know what's good for you, you'll get back in your truck and keep moving.
I'll be turning back now, officer.
Okay, Doc. Sorry for the inconvenience.
Not at all. Happy to cooperate.
For Christ's sake, Will you listen to that? It's prime time.
Jeepers, mister. You got some kind of a dog back here or something?
What is it, Polo? Polo, what is it?
What's the matter, puppy?
Come on, Polo. Polo.
Polo, baby, what's the Polo? Matter,
Polo?
Polo.
What
the hell? I'll get you, you son of a bitch. I'll get your ass.
Were you the guy pointing out where Ronnie Boyles had died?
Oh, my God, I'd forgotten about that. Oh, my God. Yes, I was also the loud-shirted fat guy with his family pointing out where Ronnie Boyles had, in fact, died and lifting up some kid on my shoulders so he could press his face into the sort of, carved hole in the telephone pole where Ronnie went smashing into. Oh my God, thank you, Mike. I'd almost forgotten about that particular appearance. So yeah, that's another memorable one. I don't know how many times I've seen Crime Wave. I've seen various incarnations of it. I saw the famous little scene version, the one that was premiered at the Toronto Film Festival and then completely rewritten, reshot, and recut for the last half hour. It was this really weird last half hour, which is brilliant, but yeah, I don't think most people got it. And at the end of the day, what John did come up with was a zillion times better. But yeah, it's a movie I've seen I can't even count the number of times I've actually put it on and watched it just because I love it and need to see it.
After he did the whole new ending and everything, was there another premiere for that, or did it just kind of go its own way? Because there was that whole the distributor and not showing it and all that kind of stuff that happened afterwards.
Yeah, I can give you a bit of the chronology of that. It was this weird little period where I was off doing my, university law school thing, and Johnny had finished the first version of the film and premiered it in Toronto, and so there was, the J. Scott and Jerry Perry hype at the time. Anyway, there was a company at the time in Toronto by the name of North Star, but North Star was an independent Canadian distribution and production entity, which was run by a rather flamboyant individual by the name of Peter Simpson, who was kind of Canada's answer to Roger Corman. And let me tell you, that's not saying much, because Corman is a god and Peter Simpson was hardly that. But he had this company, and there were some people in the background in the distribution area of the company. I know the company, though, a lot of the stuff that it made, it did a lot of the Prom Night sequels and things like that, but a lot of its indigenous production was, or the Shannon Tweed movies, things like that. There was one really cool guy who was working at North Star at the time. He was the distributor guy. His name was Danny Weinswig. Danny loved the picture. He really, really loved the picture. And he acquired the picture. But unfortunately, I think what ended up happening is that John was able to convince, the Winnipeg Film Group to take on some of the business affairs stuff. And there was some lawyer on the board of directors who was not an entertainment lawyer, but rather just a lawyer who wanted to get into entertainment law. And he worked on the contract with John pro bono. John eventually signed the contract. And then what happened was really quite horrible. Were there premieres after that? Well, there was a premiere of the new version in Winnipeg. And the new version of the film also premiered at the Vancouver International Film Festival. So by the time I came into the picture at the Winnipeg Film Group, though, it was getting really frustrating for John, because at that point, this really nice guy, Danny Weinswig, he'd moved on. He left the company. He eventually moved on to another company called Cinephile, which he took over. But at that point, John's film was languishing at North Star, and they really weren't doing anything with it until they worked out some a horrendous home video deal with a company I can't even remember the name of. It wasn't a very good company, but anyway, they insisted on retitling the film to call it The Big Crime Wave for the simple fact that by the time the film was ready for even a video release, the Coen brothers had issued a film called Crime Wave. And of course, the distributor didn't want John's film to be confused with that. I actually didn't mind the title, The Big Crime Wave, because there's so many pictures of that, you know, of the noir ilk that have big in front of them. So that's kind of, you know, cool. But the cover art wasn't very good. And, you know, I don't think they did a really good job getting it out there. They just, you know, made the sales and all that kind of stuff. And here's the horrible thing about the deal he signed with that company. I think he signed a contract which essentially tied the film up in perpetuity, or it might as well have been in perpetuity. I think the contract was for 40 years. From what I recall, yeah. Oh, God, this is so scuzzy, Mike, but I'm sure that doesn't surprise you how scuzzy distributors can be sometimes. How his lawyer let him sign this contract, I'm not quite sure. But basically, everyone on the Winnipeg end probably thought, hey, this is cool. No one probably imagined the film would not be theatrically released. So here's John. He's completely reshot, recut his film, delivered it. This has cost him tons of money. Well, you know, relatively speaking, you know, cost him about $100,000, which even, you know, back then was a fair bit of change. And so he, you know, the contract he signed was, okay, well, we'll give you this $100,000 that you need to pay your bills, and you'll be paid the $100,000 18 months after the first date of the film's theatrical release. There was, however, no clause in the contract that said there would in fact be a theatrical release. It had many clauses about every single right that the company had to exploit the picture in all media here and after ever having been invented and known to man in the future and now, you know, that kind of thing. And here's John sitting here. The film's already being released on home video. There's no theatrical release. The company is basically not even promising a theatrical release. At a certain point, they're not even answering his calls. He's stuck with a considerable debt load and no guarantee that he'll ever get his money. And he didn't know quite what to do. What ended up happening is that when I took over at the film group, I eventually went over all the papers and blah, 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 blah. You know, one of the things I thought I would do is I thought I'd try and see if the company was in default in some way. So I made a trip to Toronto and I did the thing that I was allowed to do, which was go in to their office and audit all of their books to see if there were any irregularities. And I must have spent, I don't know, about 3 days there going through all of their quote-unquote expenses. Sadly and technically, all of the expenses were legit. Couldn't get them on that. What I eventually did was there was a tiny little rep cinema, art cinema in Winnipeg called Cinema 3. Really nice guy who used to run it. I don't know whatever happened to him. A guy called Wayne Holunga. You know, Cinema 3 was kind of one of these cool places in Winnipeg, one of many to see cool movies. And Wayne had a slow period and he said, okay, I'll help you out. I'll book the picture for a week. But then what happened is every time he called Northstar to try to book the movie, they kept saying, oh, it's not available. It's not available. It's not available. Eventually, with a little bit of pressure from me and a little bit of pressure of me calling people on the Canadian government end, because, of course, keep in mind, a lot of the industry at the time was receiving tons of government support. Even film distributors, as long as they were Canadian, were getting wads of money from the Canadian government to distribute Canadian films. But of course, 9 times out of 10, of course, they would take this money, absorb it into their infrastructure and their, their cash flow and everything. And essentially, they'd just do the worst job ever with Canadian movies and basically take the money and run. And then you know, pick up American or foreign films, and that was their real bread and butter. In spite of the fact they didn't want their gravy train with the government, or their, you know, their face in the trough, the little piggies wanted to keep dining at the government trough. So a little bit of pressure from me and some friends of mine in one of the government agencies, and they eventually let Cinema and 3 in Winnipeg play the film. The film played for 1 week, and that was it. But at least that started. It kicked in that 18-month period. So John had to then wait 18 months. And then when we started trying to get the money out of North Star, they were just like, okay. They basically, they dragged their feet for a long time on it until finally, this is like unbelievable. It was quite a gravy train all around back in those days with the Canadian government supporting the arts. I contacted someone at the, you know, the film funding agency here in Canada and explained the situation. He said, oh, those fucking pricks, okay, I'll take care of that. And he did. He actually gave, he found a way of finagling a grant to the distribution company out of taxpayers' dollars, of course, so that they could finally pay John the money they owed him. This took like maybe 3.5-4 years for it to all finally come about.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. K.A.B.
Hi, I'm John Waters, and you're listening to The Projection Booth. Keep on listening, or I'll have you killed.
Okay, and we're back. Crime Wave has so many different parts to it. I mean, it's the structure of it is fascinating to me. For me, I guess my favorite parts of it are the beginnings and endings that they show from the rejected script of Crime Wave. And then also just the whole, you know, it's not necessarily a rejected thing, but the whole end of the film I find fascinating. The whole Stephen Penny's movie, basically, when they give the final beginning and ending of the Crime Wave film. So how about you guys? What are some of your best bits?
There's a few very subtle things that I love. And I agree with all the things you just said, but there's two particular jokes. Okay, three particular jokes. One is where Kim is talking about how Stephen was writing less and less, and you hear him typing in the background, and she says, until eventually he didn't write anything, and you just hear one click of the typewriter key. Cracks me up every time.
Right, yeah.
The other one is when the troublemaking rednecks are riding around in a pickup truck, the music in the background, a lot of people never notice this, but it's Smoke on the Water. It's like a big orchestral version of Smoke on the Water.
Yeah, it's like the horn section and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I've always thought that, but I've never given it much more thought than, is that Smoke on the Water?
Yeah, yeah.
And then probably my favorite, my most quoted moment from the film, like for some stupid reason, I find myself inserting this in the conversation all the time, is the phone call between Dr. Jolly and his son, where I have no idea what the son is talking about, but Dr. Jolly is talking about oranges. And I can only imagine what the other end of the conversation is, but I quote Dr. Jolly frequently in conversations whenever I have no idea what we're talking about.
I think my, and I know this is a dumb quote to say, but one of my favorite lines is about the guitar. You're going to have to wait till you get unbroke.
I love that character because he looks like a less bulkier version of Glenn Danzig too.
Yeah. I had never noticed the sausage in his pants.
Oh, God.
His costume. And I just never noticed it until I was watching it with a female friend of mine, and that was the first thing she saw and pointed out to me.
You know, I don't know if I've ever noticed that before. I'm going to have to take a look now.
I did.
Oh, it's really obvious.
I'm always looking at guys' crotches.
Right, right.
Once it's pointed out to you, it's the first thing you'll see every time you watch the movie now.
Well, I don't know if I want to even... Well, now it's going to be there. It's,
yeah, you're ruined.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Ronnie Boyles is definitely one of my favorite characters, and I love the other films that Ronnie Boyles is in, you know, like when he's out hunting and the the lawnmower scene. And there's just so many like little jokes through there, and I love how inappropriate so much of the humor is, and you know, and that it's Kim reading all these things, you know, this,
yeah,
you know, Kim was Ava Kovacs was like 11 when they started filming this movie, and here she is, like, you know, I know she's not really seeing these scenes, you know, but just that she's, you know,
she's imagining them.
Yeah, supposed to be seeing them in her head, like, you know, oh, I can see where the extension cords really are biting into your skin.
It's also, you know, it's very surreal, too. There are a ton of surreal elements to it. And my favorite scene is the couple that they're standing around. I think it's the birthday party or Christmas party, and she opens the picture, and it's her getting railed by the friend.
Yeah.
And he's like, ha, take a picture. You know, it's very stream of consciousness. It's like, it's kind of like, it reminds me of, you know, it's inspiration for Squeal of Death, you know, the Alex Winter. It's that very stream of consciousness thing going on.
Yeah.
And they do that again later in the party for the characters from the failed beginnings and endings, where she's like, look out, he's got karate. I think it is. And you hear Skip like looking through the keyhole going, oh, come on, Ronnie, don't be cruel.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I love the how they redubbed, you know, all the redubbed audio in that just kind of gives it that sense of surreality that Justin was talking about. Just kind of, you know, the words match pretty well with their mouths, but there's just kind of that otherworldly quality to everything that they're saying. And there are all those great throwaway lines that are just kind of, unless you see the movie quite a few times, you're not going to hear some of that stuff until you, you know, really start paying attention.
Yeah.
Like, such as the typewriter clacking and all that stuff. And I'm just thinking about some more of the inappropriate humor to it, like the parents doing it as they're listening and stuff.
I go over and listen to my parents do it.
Right. They do it every time my dad comes home from the club.
You know what's funny is I actually kind of relate to Stephen Penny on a level. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you why, because, you know, there's that sense that, you know, someone's struggling to create something artistically. And, you know, I feel like, you know, I've tried to write dozens of screenplays and I always have that same problem where I'm like really brilliant at coming up with the beginning and the ending, but I always struggle through the middle.
Well, Justin, there's something I want you to know. I want to tell you all about twists.
Steven. I want you to know something. I want you to know that I've never wanted anything so badly as to show you what I mean by twists. Let me show you.
Yeah, Dr. Jolly is so good. I love every scene that Dr. Jolly is in, you know, especially when he's, yeah, when he's on the phone and when he's doing his little back in the saddle again stuff. And again, another nice, well, you probably catch this on the first viewing, but just when he's there driving in his car and they have the radio dedication, you know, Todd, please come home. And he's just laughing like crazy, knowing that poor Todd's all tied up in his trunk and he'll never come back. I don't know if Todd's the name or not, but
I just love the look on his face, too, when the cop stops him and calls him doctor. And he's just he's so concerned. Mm-hmm. Like, does he know who I am? It's like, oh, MD plates. It's a brilliant performance.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing forgetting to talk about, there are actually two things that I think are really interesting. One is the fact, the story behind the film, in the sense I find fascinating, in the sense that, you know, it was screened and there was projection problems.
Right.
And then it got this weird response and he decided to do something amazing, I find amazing, which is go back and shoot the last third of the movie. Since, you know, you guys know more about it than I do, maybe you should elaborate some on that.
Skids, did you check out that original ending?
Yeah, I finally got to see the original ending, and you know, originally I couldn't wait to see the original ending because it's such a favorite film, and I'm so glad he made a different ending.
Oh yeah, totally.
It's just the other, that original ending the whole tone changes. And yeah, I can kind of understand the weird response. And it's amazing what he came up with, like when he fixed it.
But yeah, for folks listening at home, the original ending of Crime Wave, I mean, it pretty much, the real big shift happens when Stephen goes off to finally meet Dr. Jolly. And then rather than Dr. Jolly leaving the film at that point after their initial meeting, he goes to this field and there are all these kids that are playing, and there's this old woman who's riding on the back of her son, her big, like, I don't know, Tom Cullen kind of looking son there. And then they
M-O-N-N, that smells right. Mike White.
So they've got like this whole thing where he like goes off to live with them and stuff. So it's just, and then there's like the scene, you know, what John brought up when I was talking to him about this was the pivotal moment was when he goes and he's looking in the water and sees the reflection of himself, almost like, you know, this is your biggest problem is yourself. And then the son, I think the son, or was it the mom, kicks him in the ass and he goes headlong into the water. And he's like, well, the moral of the story is that sometimes you just need a boot in the ass because you are your biggest problem.
Get up, boy, get up.
Get up.
I'm gonna show you a crime so revolting and so shameful you won't believe it once you've seen it. Look here. That's it. That's it. See it? Ethan, lower the lamp. And the next time you feel yourself curling like a hot cake, remember what your old mum gave you. Now get your hide up that slope and stop messing around and finish what you started. And make your old mum proud of you.
Okay, that kind of makes sense for like the whole screenwriting aspect of the film and stuff, because you can be your biggest hurdle. But yeah, just, I don't know, the tone and everything. It reminded me of like, I don't know, I don't want to say this as an insult to Guy Madden. It reminded me of like kind of a more Guy Madden kind of feel to it. Yeah. But, you know, Guy's got more humor in most of his stuff too. I don't know. I don't know why it reminds me of that. Maybe because of the old lady, and he usually has like the old matriarch in his films or something. But yeah, it didn't work at all, man.
But it feels autobiographical. In a sense, like you feel that this is almost really his story. It's not, this is not just a character. This is maybe what he was experiencing, you know, as in the creative process as a filmmaker, is what you see on the screen in terms of what that character goes through in the sequences with the, it's very dreamlike and surreal. And this is, you're almost seeing a part of his psyche as part of his consciousness, and, you know, maybe how he really feels internally. And I think that's extremely interesting about it as well.
Plus he also talks for the first time in that original.
Right. Right. I forgot all about that. Yeah, even though the mother recognizes that he's a quiet man. But yeah, I can't even remember what his one line is. It made such an impression on us. But yeah, I was very much the same way that you were, Skiz, where I'm just like, cool, I get to see the original ending of Crime Wave. And then it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I can see why he changed this. But, you know, what he did by going back and redoing that, I mean, it made such a great film by changing that last third of it. You know, they had to bring back everybody, had to bring back Neil Lowry. He had the little scene in there of you know, Stephen Penny forgiving him and washing his feet and stuff. And then they had to reshoot everything, all the wraparound bits, all the narration of Kim, maybe one of these days to be known as Kim Penny, we don't know, so that she would be the correct age at the very end of the film. But it was just kind of strange. But I mean, I'm glad that it's out there. I'm glad that folks can see it and see that creative process.
Also, something I think we're overlooking too is just the visual style of Crime Wave.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just really phenomenal. It's just like, I have to agree with Skiz in the sense that, you know, it's one of those things you put on and it can immediately give you inspiration, because I'm sitting there and I'm watching, I'm just like, you know, you're wowed by the opening credit sequence, you know, and you're like, boy, this guy really wants to make something within his influences.
Right.
And so you get out this, you know, great old movie type of stuff. And then, you know, his choice of camera selection, his choice of camera angles in the front, where just how he's photographing Kim, you know, when she's in the classroom, he's kind of low on that. And it's, the colors are very saturated and it gives it this really wonderful aesthetic. And then, you know, getting out of that, and then you get into more surreal moments, which is, you know, where he cuts to the, you know, the shot of the guy in all the beginnings where he's got the sunlight, you know, that thing behind, that's just brilliant. So it's one of those inspirational things where it's like, oh my God, this vision is so original.
And all of it was shot on 16 millimeter, which, you know, for 16 millimeter, it looks more interesting than a lot of films shot on 35 millimeter.
Exactly. And there's something fabulous about 16. You know, it's, you look at the, some of the great films that have been done on 16, and I have to wonder, maybe you know, Skiz, is the stock that he's talking about in the movie, that 7241, is that what he actually shot the film on?
I don't know for sure, but I would almost guess that it is.
Right. I assume that's probably what he shot it on, because it's, you know, they're so very saturated too, which makes it look almost like, it reminds me mildly of a Serkian melodrama of the 50s, you know, because those colors are very washed out, you know, they're very just basic plain colors, you know, very red, very blue, very green, very yellow. There's no tints, no different, you know, this is not like an olive green. It's just very hard coloring.
And yeah, I love that about it. And then I enjoy the little animation stuff that he does, such as the sunlight kind of effect behind people's head. And then I love the Stephen Penny theme park with the balloons coming up and everything, you know.
I love the Buddy Holly at the beginning when he's railing the chicken against the door, okay. And the arms are going through.
Right.
That's awesome.
The voiceover guy is amazing. The music for it is so great. I mean, I can't even imagine what Crime Wave would be without that music behind it, because it's another character to the film itself.
I've shown that movie to people, and like years ago, and now years later, they haven't seen it since, but they still tell me that song is stuck in their head.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that one, once it's in there, man, it doesn't get out forever.
Didn't this film directly contribute to him directing the second season episodes of Kids in the Hall too?
Yeah, and then John's made a couple other films. He made one called Marker. And what else has he made? He made
Invasion, Top of the Food Chain.
Yeah. Well, I was going to get to that one eventually, guys. Come on. But yeah, and then he shot some episodes of Once a Thief, the John Woo show. And then, yeah,
Maniac Mansion.
Thank you. That's what the other one. And then, yeah, he shot Top of the Food Chain, which was released on DVD as Invasion. And when they were sending out the script for that movie, the producers were sending out the script, and they had already gotten John to agree to direct it. They were sending out the script along with copies of Crime Wave to the different actors, and that's what really got a lot of the actors on board that were in that movie, such as Campbell Scott was just like, I want to work with this guy after he got to see Crime Wave. So that was pretty.
It's like Singles 2?
Yeah.
Or Top of the Food Chain.
Top of the Food Chain. And he picked that one.
Or Dying Young again. Dying Young 2.
He made a good choice.
He never really died.
No. He came back from the dead. It was a zombie film. Yeah, Top of the Food Chain / Invasion is also a winner to me. I mean, there's a lot of, again, weird humor to it. And I was very surprised that Pays didn't write this one. It just seemed to fit in well with his style of stuff. So, Skiz, you want to talk about that one a little bit?
Yeah, because when we brought him to the Maryland Film Festival in 1999 to show Crime Wave, he had this new film, Top of the Food Chain, which had not premiered yet. In fact, I think it was supposed to premiere at Toronto that September, but Maryland was in May, so we got sort of an unofficial premiere, I guess. I kind of remember him being not so proud of the film, I think because he didn't write it, but when the audience reacted to it, I think he finally realized he had something to be proud of, because there's so many quotable moments in that film. I mean, I like that film as much as I like Crime Wave. It's hysterical.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of fits in. Like, there was a little rash of films a few years ago where it was like, we're going to make a science fiction film, and it's going to be as cheesy as the old ones from the 50s. And they had, like, Alien Trespass and all this kind of shit. And those, frankly, to me, are really shitty. But Invasion is where it's at. I mean, he hits that tone and goes right over it.
Don't be so quick to cancel out, like, the Larry Blumer films, you know, like the Screaming Skull, Screaming Forehead, you know, the Lost Skeleton of Cadaver, you know, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Those are really great.
Bad.
Yeah.
I've only seen Lost Skeleton of Cadaver, but I haven't seen the other ones. But I mean, but there were, I would say, bigger budget ones where they tried to do that kind of, you know.
Yeah, like Mars Attacks.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah. Yeah, just like Mars Attacks. And they didn't do it at all, but Top of the Food Chain is what hit it.
The body was scavenged by a wild animal. This pattern of teeth marks is unusual. Anywhere from 200 to 202 teeth, but I can't be any more specific than that. As for cause of death, used to say he wasn't eaten alive.
One of the sad things about Top of the Food Chain, it premiered at the Toronto, well, it unofficially premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival. And since it was a Canadian film, you know, this would have been an ideal film for the Midnight Madness series that they have, which is just like all the fucked up shit that they show. Like, you know, anytime fucking Takashi Miike's got a new film, they put it in the Midnight Madness program. And Top of the Food Chain would have been perfect for Midnight Madness. It would have kept the audience awake. It would have made him laugh. It would have entertained. And it would have introduced a whole new group to John Pace. But unfortunately, since it was a Canadian film, the Canadian program snatched it up and said, no, we're going to show this. So in essence, nobody got to see it that year.
And yeah, anybody that goes to that festival knows to avoid the Canadian films.
Oh yeah, like the plague, man. John is definitely one of the exceptions to the reputation that Canadian films have. So, and then John, unfortunately, has suffered in that. And then I've been personally trying to get Crime Wave out on DVD for a while. I know John tried to get it out on DVD years ago, and it was owned by a group called Elias Brothers owned this film. No, it was, Elijah C. Scuggs owned this film. And he was just like, you know, I'm waiting for the Jake and the Fat Man movie to be
when
made.
When Jake and the Fat Man comes out, Crime Wave will come out.
Exactly. So no, Alliance is one of these Canadian entertainment companies, and they had the rights for it for a lot of years. And when John was trying to get them to release it, they're like, yeah, sure, we'll release it. Somebody can buy the rights as long as they buy the rights for these 10 other shitty films. And so they were trying to get this package thing going on. But now another company owns the rights, who will remain nameless for now. And then I've been trying to go out to all these different video companies and say, there's this great film, you really need to put it out on DVD. And I've gotten like one bite so far, but then I haven't heard anything back from them in months. So I'm still pushing, still doing what I possibly can to get this film out there. And when it comes out, I don't want it to be just the movie. You know, I want it to be like the deluxe edition and, you know, have the original ending on there, have some of John Pace's short films on there. You know, to me, this movie needs to be seen by a whole lot of people, and it needs to be seen in the right way. But saying that, I would be happy if just this freaking movie came out on DVD so more people could see it. Even if it was one of those like stripped down Mulholland Drive kind of editions where you get nothing with it, just the movie. But
what if it was in a twofer with Night of the Living Dead?
Okay, sure. Yeah, no problem. It could be in a twofer with Ishtar 16, and I'd be fine with that.
How is that?
Let me tell you, Midnight Madness, I fell asleep at 12:05. Sorry, Elaine May. I couldn't sit through the rest of it.
You should be apologizing to Warren Beatty.
He should be apologizing to my fist. Skiz, final thoughts on the film?
I'd be happy if somebody just took the 16mm print and blew it up to 35 and started touring it around theaters.
That would be great, too. This is one of those movies where, like, you know, the Alamo Drafthouse should be showing it, the New Beverly should be showing it, all those, like, hipster places should be showing this film at least once every 2 months.
Well, they would if you would call it an exploitation film.
It's a Canexploitation.
It's like a cult film that hasn't quite found its full cult yet. I never knew what the photo he has of the rooster and they're heating the bottom of the table. I've never...
Well, I will tell you about that, Skiz. That's a scene where I think it's another one of those where he's kind of trying to tell Kim about how movies are made, and he's talking about how, like, he puts this acetylene torch underneath the chicken, there's a metal plate, and then the chicken is going to dance, and then
that's an old Freak Show gag from the 20s.
Okay, yeah. And then there's a mishap occurs, and the next thing you see is like him running up to the garage door, like it's kind of got that beaded glass look to it, to the garage door, and his hair is on fire. And then they use that clip of the hair on fire when they're doing the whole montage of Stephen Penny's other films, you know, how they were dubbed in all the different languages and all that. Yeah. And then you get to see that just for like a second. So that's the story with the rooster or the cocky actor.
Troma has nothing on that exploding head.
Yeah, that's exploding head is awesome.
I remember you said he had just seen Scanners or something, and he knew that he had to have an exploding head in his next film.
Yeah. That was his homage to Cronenberg. It's really interesting how much he mentions Cronenberg as an influence in that documentary, too.
Well, you know, when you're Canadian, you got like four people that you can look up to. You got Cronenberg, Guy Madden, and then Adam McGoyan and who else? Bruce McDonald, maybe? And I'm not a big Adam McGoyan fan. So, hey, big ups to Skiz Cizik for coming and joining us on the projection booth today. Keep up with Skiz by checking out his website, skiz.net, or his alternate website, which is nsopr.gov.
I had to go there to figure out what that was.
I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you had some fun there. So that brings us to the end of another episode of the Projection Booth. Next week, we'll be putting on our aprons and attempting to make some chili-flavored cookies as we take a look at the 1989 not-on-DVD action parody Tracks, and we'll be featuring interviews that Justin did with the stars of the film Shadow Stevens and Robert Davey. In the meantime, please visit our webpage, projection-booth.com, for more goodies, including links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. And please stop by iTunes and give the Projection Booth a few stars and maybe even a nice review. You know, it really does help.
Amigo.